Colorful Sinai and Patrick on Colorful Radio.
Welcome to the Voices of Windrush with me, Sinai Flary, and my co-host, Mr. Patrick Vernon. On today's show, we will be asking how we can preserve the Windrush legacy through family and documentaries. Joining us in the studio today is Yvonne Archer and her father, Stanley Roy Archer, who is more fondly known as Master Roy, who are going to be talking to us about their book and their family history. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
I wanted to first ask you, how did you first hear about the Windrush scandal?
Well, for me, it's strange because someone had sent me a WhatsApp about someone who was detained, I believe. I can't remember the exact details because there have been so many stories since that time. But the thing was that I knew the person's sister. And so then it became quite personal. And then I started to delve in a bit more and realized that this person had been here and had come here as a child. And I didn't understand why they suddenly had to go. And I think that was the first idea I had, that what I'd been predicting in the 80s, I believe it was, I used to say to friends, have you told your granddad and your grandma, have you told your mum and dad to get their British passports taken out? When Mrs. Thatcher was in power, I remember saying that. And so it all came back to a head for me, and I suddenly realised that this is real. People were saying, oh, it's fine, they can't throw us out, you're joking. They cannot do it. We've been here since the 50s, you're mad. We work here, we have an NHS. This is what people were saying to me. I said, no, I made sure that my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, had his British passport. I double-checked that my father had his British passport so that I would be safe. We were warned. So It was a real sad, sad day when I got that WhatsApp.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, for your dad, how did he feel? How did you feel?
How did you hear about the Windrush scandal?
Well, I heard about the Windrush after speaking about another incident that happened in Canada. I hope I'm not coming off your track. Eh? Just explain it. There's another saga about that there's a ship pick up some young Jamaican. They were looking for soldiers to come to fight the war in England. And this ship pick up the young Jamaicans, fit boys, and they get as far as Halifax or one of those port in Canada. They were surrounded by a German destroyer, so the ship could not get out of port. Apparently, what really happened there, they were there for a long time in the winter, the heights of winter. And I remember some of them came back to Jamaica, to our district, with one foot frostbitten. Mm. They were not looked after, and they sent them back. And then after we've been trying to raise eternal devil about it, then this Windrush saga came up. But before, I wish somebody could take and have a look at these people. And they get nothing. They couldn't leave the port because the German ship that was out there to destroy them. After they do get out, they send them back with one foot, one arm to Jamaica. And then little after, the Windrush thing came along. But then it was not that long after, because I leave Jamaica as a young man, 1954. And I think the Windrush was about 1952.
Oh, that's so 1948.
Was a big lad. Yeah. Big lad. Not big man, but big lad. Because I've always been active and a manly boy. So, you know.
Lots of responsibilities.
It's a story that adult used to run boys away for their company, but they never troubled me. I can always sit there and listen to them from morning till night. And we have some sad story about the treatment around that time with our fellow men. So, you know, that one also sticking in my, not the Windrush alone, but I forget the name of the ship, but I can name you some of the name of the young men that they picked up in Jamaica that get frostbitten, come back to Jamaica, 1 foot, one arm, wooden legs, all the fine kind of thing.
I think as well, Dad, when I remember you trying to understand what was going on with this Windrush business, you were actually in Jamaica at the time.
Oh, yes.
And they sent a car for him to go down to the University of the West Indies to talk to them about. He didn't really understand. He was phoning me and saying, what is going on? And when he went there, all he did was took out his very first British and Commonwealth passport and said, here you go. Read what it says. And it had been signed by, was it the Governor General or someone at the time, saying all people who come across this, the bearer of this passport must afford him or her whatever they need in order to assist them on their journey. And my dad took that to heart. And to that was what really upset him about the Windrush.
It's settled.
Going back on their word.
I couldn't explain. But the passport says, and passport is an official bit of document. And it says, they should assist us with any needs that arises. But they didn't. So, you know.
How did you feel? Did you feel betrayed?
Yeah.
Was you upset?
Upset, yes. I'm more than upset.
Yeah.
Go back on your written word. That's, a bit more than upset.
Yeah.
And coming to see years after, I leave Jamaica in 1954. That's only 2 years after the Windrush thing, but it was more during the war as a young man, a young boy, the one in Canada. But it is the one that really stick out in my mind.
Yeah.
Was it Enselwood? He actually remembers the names of people that used to be in his district working and having to lean up to see if they could get a little bit of work because they weren't provided with any support, any assistance. They never actually got to Britain, but they had risked their lives for Britain thus far. And so that was the upsetting thing, wasn't it?
That upset me more than anything else. Not the Windrush. We could do something about the Windrush, but we couldn't do anything about the other world there. And I say a lot of young, able men leave our district, get stuck in Canada because they couldn't leave port of the German ship outside waiting to sink them. You know?
Yeah, that was treacherous times of the Second World War because obviously there were lots of German ships and U-boats around the Caribbean Sea, the Atlantic. As well, and that was, you know, I mean, we've just been hearing about the late Sam King documentary, and I remember Sam King talking about his experiences. You weren't quite sure if you could even get to UK because just in case there were U-boats,
Yes. But also people didn't realise how much they sacrificed. People were giving away their one cow and their one this and actually giving money that they'd saved up when they had very little. And that, I think, the hurt that my dad was expressing all the time, every time we spoke on the phone over the Windrush incident, when it all came to the fore in this country, was just phenomenal, really. I was, you know, the hurt that he's feeling, that it's almost like mental anguish. It's an outrage.
My parents, they feel the same as well.
Really?
They're in the Midlands and they're in their 80s and they feel very angry about that. But what's interesting, I first met both of you, I met you probably about how many years ago now? I met you
over a decade maybe.
When your book came out about your dad. And what we want to explore is there's not many elders who document their life stories in a way. There's some different, there's a number of, I can think of Sam King, there's a gentleman I made a documentary about called Eddie Martin Noble. But there's not many documentaries, publications about elders from the Windrush generation recording their life history.
No.
I want to know why you did it. And with hindsight now, it's even more important. Your book's even more important. So can you explain to our listeners, why did you decide to write this fantastic book?
Well,
and for your dad, why did you share? Because some elders in the community don't want to share their stories. They'd rather keep it quiet and say, that's none of your business. It's, why did you decide, you know, I'm ready to share this?
Why did you decide you're ready to tell me your story?
Which story?
All of your stories.
Well, the book story is a different one. I tell you, the one that really hurts me is the one I'm telling you about.
Yeah, we talked about that now. So what we're trying to work out is, okay, so Patrick wants to know, and Sinai wants to know, what encouraged you to share your story with me? Because a lot of you elders don't want to talk to us about your life. Like, there's an embarrassment, or it's taboo almost.
It's that wasn't the real thing. You see, I had to grow up by myself. So there was plenty of story to be told about Jamaica. And I will tell you, it's just because many of us short the knowledge of reading and writing, white really interesting books and different stories and happenings and things that could help some people, educational wise, financial wise, maybe medicine wise, herbs. This is the whole of the outlook I have in life that could happen. You see? So there was, my reading ability wouldn't take me longer. So I always tell our stories because it's just the two of us. She didn't have any mother, so I grew up from, she's small. So you have to be the cook and the bottle washer. So there's plenty of story, and the more you tell the story, is the more you see things that seems of value. Maybe something happened to boys, you hide it. But then long after, you say, you know what, something, that's very important. That's useful. And that is what
and for me,
telling our stories. And I didn't know she was doing this. I didn't tell her to do it. In fact, she gave me the book when the book finished.
So
I would just write down what he was telling me in the best way possible. Then I would read back to him what I'd written. And he would say, no, take that out, put that in. Actually, that's the name of that. Put it like this, use that phrase. So he actually wrote the book. I was more or less, it was dictated to me.
I think the parlance says you were a ghostwriter.
I was, absolutely. No. And what happened, what was great about it, was that the things that may have affected our elders as they were growing up and the experiences they had here that would affect their well-being and their mental health and their relationship with their children, especially when they'd left children abroad and had brought them over later on during the Windrush, this was almost a therapeutic experience. It was for me because it helped me to understand why my father was certain ways. Where you might find your parents are very harsh, or your parents don't seem to understand what it is that you're going through, or where you expect them to go off the rails at you about something and actually they just sit and listen quietly. All of his stories helped me to understand what our elders had been through and why they are the way they are, especially in this country. Their experiences have shaped them.
Yeah.
And I think The idea of writing the book was, and publishing it ourselves in our family name, Archer, was that he needs to have his voice. Mm-hmm. It was important that he was able to say his story, tell his story in his own words, in his own way. So you'll find that a lot of the language used and the proverbs and the stories that he's chosen to include are according to what he sees as important.
Where can our listeners purchase your book?
Right. So that's going to be a bit of a complicated thing. We do have a website under our piece, and piece is spelled P-E-A-C-E, of history. I've had major problems trying to get this out there. As you can see, the cover's got a military photo of my father because he was drafted, and people don't know that story of our elders. Mm. He didn't want to go in the army, but he was. And so I tried to get it into the national... What's
Imperial War Museum?
That's the one. Yeah, thanks, Patrick. The
Imperial War Museum. A lot of people tried, yeah.
They won't take our publications. They don't want our stories in there. Now I'm going to try and take it to the Migration Museum. But if people would like to email me, I am happy to send it out by post and trust that they will send me their £10.
Please do give your email address.
Do you want my email address? Yeah. Okay. Yvonne, that's Yvonne, _ Archer, Archer, at hotmail.com. So it's Yvonne _ Archer at hotmail.com. And if anyone out there has a bookshop or a gift shop and they'd like to stock some of our books, we'd happily provide them.
Yeah. Just before you go, I wanted to ask you, we had our first National Windrush Day this year on the 22nd of June. I want to know, how do you feel we can preserve the Windrush legacy? And that's also a question for your dad as well.
How we can preserve the Windrush legacy. So we need to continue to tell our stories. If your own parents are not telling you their story, go to another elder who you know, a neighbour, a friend, an elder in your church, in your mosque, whoever it is. Try and see if you can just get snippets of story. Don't feel that you have to do a big chunk of work. It can be one tiny story that gives you the significance of something that happened in the Windrush. And let's see if we can't put something together. Patrick's great at that kind of thing. But we do all need to support. And in fact, why not all try and encourage each other to take off the 22nd of June from work? Yeah. How amazing would that be if all the people that are from the Commonwealth or from had some connection to the Windrush were not at work on that day? You book it off in advance and take that day and let's do... have our activities and exchange stories and take our elders with us to spaces, create spaces. Even if it's a tea party, let's create those spaces. Book restaurants and let's go and do this and have them talk and record their stories. I think that's one way. There are loads and I think there are lots of ways forward, but I plan to do that. Mm-hmm. After all Patrick's hard work, we need to recognise that and thank him. And not let it slip away, because that's what will happen. And don't wait for other people to fund us either. Don't say there's no funding. Let's just get on with it. Do something in your house. Have a picnic in the park.
Yeah, yeah.
There are loads of ideas. Yeah.
What do you think we should do to celebrate people like yourself who came here and helped to build up Britain?
To be honest with you, I've been sitting still on this. Because it's a wee bit upsetting, and I say, grew up in part of the my younger life in or my useful time in Jamaica, immigrated to London in England in 1954. The Windrush was only 2 years. Prior to that, something like that.
You keep saying actually no.
And then, although we didn't have the modern technology of broadcasting, and the other thing that beat us, including myself, is our reading ability. That was, so they get away with a lot of things that they should be exposing, because you can't tell the story. There's nobody to tell the story to, no auction. If it's auction, it'd have to be a violent auction because they're going to try and stop you and you want to say, no, you can't stop me, So this is where riots and fighting the soldiers and lay with them and the roadblock and cut down trees across the road and pin them into a pen and night them can go over the hills and the valleys and the gullies. That was what happened when I was a boy, Some really, war going on between the white soldiers and the stone men and the cutlass men there in the country, because it was rough time for us as well, you know.
So how would
that
is
irrelevant or answer any of your question or the picture. If you look at the picture, we had nothing to fight beside your hands and whatever material, stones or blocking road and so on.
So know? How would we commemorate then the Windrush Dad? Do you think we should be listening to your stories, basically?
We have to listen.
Of the people.
You have to listen to these stories, you know. And because of all of your education today, you would judge for yourself, or if who live a life, people that actually go through these type of thing, if we can find them just before their days are over, mm-hmm. they might have some real story to tell you, you know. Yeah. Laughing one and cry make you cry too. Mm. Yeah. Some of the stories.
Yeah. So it's
to
the
find
person.
It's to try and find people of that age group, because my real research I would like to see done was a ship at the, I don't know the name of the ship. I was only a young man or a boy. Hmm? But it picked up a lot of young men in Jamaica to come and fight the war here via Canada.
That is something that probably you could look into, Patrick, and maybe a few historians. We can see if we can find out the name of that ship Mr. Archer's talking about.
Well, definitely. I mean, that's interesting, because I heard similar stories more also to do with the First World War, because when people went down to Seaford in Sussex, it was so cold down there, people had suffered from frostbite as well. So there's something about when we are deployed, they're not our well-being is not taken into consideration.
No.
You know, we come from a hot climate and no clothing, no proper attire, and just left to, you know, suffer.
It says that we were not valued as highly as the other troops and the other people who had volunteered. Mm. And unfortunately, that feels like a bit of a Windrush legacy for me, in that our elders who came over because they were asked to come here, and people like my father who served, were not valued. So now their children are not valued. And our children, in a way, are not being valued. There's a national, like, I mean, this Windrush thing is a huge umbrella for me. So I'm looking at things like, why are we all not jumping up and down? Our children are being stabbed every day. It just, every weekend, it defies all logic. So, what it does say to me is, are we valuing ourselves? If we don't value ourselves and our elders and their stories and record them for them, because as Dad says, we're more educated than they are. We might not be greatly educated, but we can read and write to a higher level than they could. And if they're willing to share those stories and pull up all of that painfulness from their past, we ought to respect that and help them to put their stories down and help them make sense of what happened in the past, because in turn that will help us to make sense of what is happening to us here and now.
Yeah. Yvonne Archer and your father, Mr. Roy Archer, thank
Mas
you so
Roy,
much.
Sir.
Mas Roy, yes.
Mas Roy.
Thank you so much for joining us today on The Voices of Windrush. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you both and hearing your stories from Jamaica right up until now.
Just one thing, dear, that you mentioned, Mas Roy, I have, because of jobs I've done and I have called worse names, so you can, no matter what name, no matter what name you want. But it's a story or a long tale, you know.
Yeah.
And these things from when I was a young boy, sick, you know, the war, I can remember it day to day.
Yeah.
The stories and the telling, you know, so it holds me down when things like this happen. And nobody to take sides or come out with the real stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But he carries on working hard, is one thing that we have to say. He's 87 now.
Wow.
And is happy to continue with his community service, community work. He's always been doing that since I was a child.
He just started.
As a single father. And he
just started.
It feels like he's just starting.
Oh, fantastic.
A lot more work to go.
Fantastic. So, it's been an honor to meet you. And thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you
for
inviting us.
Thank you.
Okay.
Colorful Sinai and Patrick on Colorful Radio.
Welcome to the Voices of Windrush with me, Sinai Flary, and my co-host, Mr. Patrick Vernon, talking about how you can document your family history and preserve it. Now, in the studio, we are joined by Sharon Tomlin, who is a genealogist and family historian, and also Adrian Stone, who is a genealogist. Thank you so much for joining us in the studio.
Hey, thank you.
I wanted to ask you first, before we start, how did you feel when the whole Windrush scandal unfolded, and this is for both of you?
I think my direct response was really setting up the Tracing Your Windrush Roots workshop, because it's all about, you know, that legacy, that, you know, that generation coming up. Obviously, for many of us, we don't know when they came over, so I think it raised the questions amongst family. The dialogue started to speak about the family and when they came. And then the workshop, I guess, was the first step for people to start looking at, you know, when their family came, how old they were, their full names, all these sort of questions, and where they were from. So the workshop helps people look into their family ancestry through these events, life events like births, marriages and deaths. So it all connects, really. So the Windrush, many people talk about, you know, obviously the first wave that came in 1948. And through the workshop, you can actually find these passenger lists to actually, you know, that they said the landing cards were lost. But there are other records as well. So we reveal that in the workshop.
And for you, Sharon, I mean, how did you feel when the whole scandal unfolded?
Well, first of all, I was rather disgusted, very impressed with the fact that Patrick has pioneered some of the response to that. That was really important. Another thing I was concerned about is the community's response, because it revealed the lack of gaps in knowledge, not only about, as Adrian rightfully said, about the history and the family history, but also the sources they could have used that to enable them to be recognized as people that have arrived here. And alongside that, my concern was also about how do we galvanize a community to really formalize responses to this issue, because as well as that, I also work as a community organizer, so empowerment of the communities is very, very important, and understanding these various processes that have been placed, you know, quite suddenly. And it's good that we have journalists out there that have been exploring this as a concern, who helped to raise the issue alongside people such as Patrick in the first place. So yes, my initial response was to look at, again, the same, put the information about out about the passenger ship's manifest, and to get people to look at any records from 1960 and earlier, the Board of Trade specifically for incoming passengers, and that's record for anybody that migrated to the UK from about 1890 through to about 1960. So I thought, right, let's get looking at these things. And also we did some things locally as well.
Okay. I mean, what sort of things could an average person like myself do to document, say, my family history? I mean, are there online tools? What sort of things can the average person do? And that's a question for both of you.
Well, for me, there's a lot of good quality online tools out there now. It doesn't mean that they have the widest database of information for the Caribbean, African Caribbean group. I'm going to be honest with you. For example, there's a website. Most of them are fee-paying. They're charged for their services. But you do have also another website called Family Search, and that's for free, and that's accessible to anybody. Yes, they're the records of the Latter-day Saints. They call themselves Church of Jesus Christ now, and that's freely available to all people. And that's records dated from 17th century through to about 1995, so that's fairly recent, you know, but those are tend to be death records. So you can do that online. Then you've got the apps that are available. But if you wanted to start, it's more about collecting that information from the family, and don't ask the families. This is what I've picked up over the years. Too many direct questions. It shuts down dialogue. We've got personal reasons, especially in our community, as to why we don't open up quite quickly about the information we have in our arsenal. So what people tend to do is we've got to sort of be a bit Machiavellian. Sorry, it doesn't mean telling a lie. I'm just encouraging the fact that you need to ask questions around about their history without directly asking when they were born and their business about when they arrived here and which name they came in, because that's some of the issues that's emerged.
Let me stop you there, Shan, because I'm just so different. I went straight to the juggler. I really did. And also just let people know that, you know, I'm a genealogist, but my very first record was found by Sharon. So we've met along this genealogical journey of mine. But yes, for me, it was just really like quite bold. I didn't really think about it in some ways. I just asked the questions because I was so passionate. Anybody does family, you know, history research, you know, it's just something, you know, you're just so excited to know. You're so passionate to know. I think people can feel that. And I think it's just about the intention of what you're looking for. Because most people, as you know, there are some skeletons in the closet that they think you're coming for, but you're looking at the deeper roots.
That's
not,
right.
Not the recent history, you
that's
know,
right.
And it's been, you know, not the jacket in the wardrobe. That's not what we're looking for. So yeah, I think once people know that you're quite pure with your intentions of what you intend to do with the information, they do open up. And as people get to an older age, they do tend to share their childhood stories, which would have been very difficult in the past to achieve. So I did get that response. But if you'd asked that question, how many years ago you were the getter? You know. So I came at a good time 10 years ago tracing it, and I did trace over 6,000 doing my tree. So a massive, you know, amount of families that I had to connect with just to get the background and information gathered, which is really important. So and it all depends where you're researching in the Caribbean as well. We specialize in tracing African Caribbean roots, and my parents are Jamaican. So if you're looking at Jamaica, there's some records going back to the mid-1600s and back further. Depends where your lines go. But as Shara has mentioned, there's many online sources, many other sources in the archives. But the first thing is the oral history and getting these dates right. Because you may have heard people say they've never been registered and things like
that.
That's right. And the records will prove otherwise. And it may be a pet name and things like that that you may come across. But building a basic family tree and looking at the siblings' lines, and, you know, then we can start, and the districts and the villages, there's lots of bits we need to then go into the records office with.
Absolutely.
Can I just comment? So before I'll ask you a broader question about the whole stuff around family and genealogy in the UK context, what the landing card stuff, let's clarify that. So obviously, as part of that, when the news broke, and then it was later found that the landing cards were meant to have been destroyed, how critical are the landing cards? Are they that relevant? Because not everyone came on ships. And secondly, with now people realising they now have to go for the task force to sort out the documentation, what basic things can people should be thinking about if they are going to sort out their citizenship? And this is going to be an issue also for EU citizens as well anyway, but what some basic things that people need to do in the context of their immigration status as part of vis-a-vis their family history?
Yes, of course. I hear you. Yeah, and this is quite a bit of a tragedy, really. The fact that there are, even though they've claimed, because in many administrations, they're given a date and a time to destroy records, but yet these landing cards became available. They're crucial because on the documents, on these landing cards, are very important information, not only the age of the person and their names, but also their marital status, the address they were going to when they arrived in the UK. And that's one way to help track through the electoral registers, etc., their longevity in a particular at a particular address, for example. It also documents their occupation, which is quite crucial to where they've been placed in society. And in addition to that, it will also add information, especially if the families have travelled together, so you get a whole lot of information there and then. And the landing card, the information is absolutely crucial, and it's a form of, it is evidence. It is evidence and comes under statutory type, sector type work, so it has to be, you know, available to people that are, you know, that
and
really
accessible.
Need that.
And it's accessible.
And making it accessible.
Yeah
absolutely.
It really
so
is.
Yes, it was a travesty that people weren't aware of this and use it and could use it as a tool to help them with their... So in preparation, I would suggest that keep all the passports, everyone, no matter how old it is, just keep that. It attracts, you know, whatever they and people have arrived in on. In terms of their personal families, information about where that, because especially for the Caribbean community, structures such as people are christened in church, usually a majority of the people in the islands tend to be, you know, an event in church. There's bound to be some record or information there so that, you know, that's trackable for them on a personal basis if they can bring that information. And bound to be school records, because at a certain period, it was compulsory that children were to attend school. So there's bound to be some sort of school records for sure in the structures. And for older people, they may not. And it's another thing about the social history. In I know in specifically for Jamaica, standardized education started about age 7. For people my dad's age, for example, that's what the case was up until a certain point when, you know, we had reception and nursery, etc. Mm. But standardized education started at age 7. So it's being mindful of using, you know, using investigative techniques, good quality questions, so that it can, you know, elicit those information that about the person's personal history.
On the wider question, you know, I've known you guys for a number of years, and you've both done fantastic work around family history, genealogy, advocacy around family history. So if you remember Roots, the TV program.
Yes.
I think everybody remembers.
Not everyone. I can remember my nephew and nieces. They didn't know about Roots. And I had a box set, and when they stayed with me for the weekend, they watched the whole box set. I'm not joking. This was some years ago now.
Yeah, they're actually doing reruns on, I think it's True Entertainment on TV at the moment.
That's
yeah.
right.
Okay. Yeah. And don't forget they remade it as well.
Yes.
So what's interesting? Roots galvanized a real explosion in America of African Americans creating their own family history societies and organisations around family history and events and all that kind of stuff. And also, is that impacting on the continent in terms of in Ghana, particularly around the homecoming, and in Gambia, Roots Festival, other places. But in the UK, for some reason, and even now, and even despite the Windrush scandal, what more needs to be done so we are embracing and talking from a family history perspective? Because we're not really talking about it in that way compared to in America or even the Caribbean. What, Adrian, you're on a mission. I know you're a man on a mission.
I'm getting ready to answer this. I've got something. I've got the answer. Yeah. I've got the answer.
From your perspective, what is required to raise our game to make sure that everyone's doing this stuff?
And what resources
are required to make this happen?
Yeah, I just think, I think if you go back to Roots as an example, I think even, was it my generation? Just kind of tail end of it, but telling you my age. But the feeling was anger. The feeling was anger. I didn't think it resonated over here for people to look at their ancestral lines and, you know, definitely to embrace their African heritage. But there was an anger there. And for me, doing my genealogy, you know, research, it was a celebrative thing. I've always looked at it to share it with the family, to bring the family together. 10 years ago, my journey started, and I went to America and did a family presentation in terms of showing how we're connected and showing how I found my actual African ancestor. And that's one of the things I've actually found on my journey along my fifth great-grandmother, that she was from Nigeria, from the Igbo tribe, from doing the paper trail research, not through DNA that most people have done. But the feeling of that journey was, you know, that feeling proud, instead of this, you know, in terms of looking at compensation, what they owe us and what happened and what, I was more thinking of how this information could unite us. Mm. So that unity I'm finding, that's happening in the Tracing Your Windrush Roots workshop. Instead of me just speaking just about my story, they're finding their own personal story. So I think lots of work has been done about the general sort of icons that we're hearing in Black history. Yeah. But it's time to find the heroes in your own history, which is why I named the company Own History, because it's about your story. Mm. And I think that's made a massive difference into the approach of people. And, you know, and this is why when you're speaking to the elders and they can see, like, your intentions, they're sharing that information, and it's bringing people together, doing family reunions, and also people discovering in the workshop they're related. I found some fascinating things. You know, sometimes it's an emotional roller coaster, but you're finding people are connected in so many ways. And I think that's what genealogy does. It brings us all together because we've got a shared history. Mm. But it's the feeling of it, it's the tone of it. And I think that's what, you know, the workshops do when they're practically based.
So, what happens in the workshops? What do you do in the workshops? How do you get people to start? Do people automatically start bringing their paperwork, or they start, or they're just sitting there listening and tell me what can I do?
Everything and everything is happening, because I always say it's beautiful when you have a family tree, because then once I show you the skills, the online sources, what's in the archives, what's possible, and show you live examples, you then deliver that. and you get the one-to-one assistance as well. Mm-hmm. So you can just start with a few names, grandparents, and that can bring you back to the 1900s, early 1900s, and potentially find a birth certificate. Some people have that information, but don't know the next step. And we show you many of those next steps in the workshop. Mm-hmm. And there's also people who've actually started, but they've got stuck in the 1800s and don't know again what the next step is. Yeah? So it's aimed at absolute beginners, as well as people with some experience, to widen the approach, giving them some strategies, giving them a methodological approach about searching in different generations as well, and different sources that they've already been using, but to refine it and but show it live as an example. And that's the difference. Mm-hmm. And that's something we're all sharing together. And believe you me, I mean, just the response, the feeling, it just makes that journey all worth it. Yeah. Because we all started from a place of passion, wasn't necessarily thinking about this as a business or the Windrush, because the research started many years ago. Mm-hmm. But the importance of the groundwork, especially that the Mormons have done to digitize these records, make them available, you know, allows people can now to do this from the comfort from the home, but it's about how to do it, and that's what the importance of Tracing Your Windrush workshops is about.
Yeah,
great. Yeah. So, Sharon, what about you? I've known you for quite a while, and
thank you.
You, I know that back in the day you had a family history group.
Yes, I did.
I think it was linked with the BCA, wasn't it? Black Culture Archives.
At one stage, Yeah, and they've asked me to come on.
From your perspective, what needs to happen around all of us doing this stuff around family history? Well, is there still barriers or blockages? Is it always still in denial? Or hasn't the Windrush maybe could be a catalyst?
Definitely, I like that. I can't thank you, because you two are a pioneer in this field, Patrick. Thank you so much. And people like Stephen Porter as well, I've got to give kudos to him as well. But in terms of what is needed now, one question was posed to me recently about, and I was invited to lead on a discussion about creating a genealogical society, which is probably one method we could galvanize, a bit like the American model, and have something where we can connect more meaningfully to Africa. So that could be something, but it would mean it being run on a voluntary basis, and it would mean setting up governance and get people to understand structures. So that would have to be a slow burning process, but it doesn't mean that it wouldn't have meaningful intent. It would do, because a genealogical society would help galvanize all sorts of materials. That's number one. For me, in terms of like about the same experience as Adrian, in terms of when you're working in the workshops, it's wonderful when you watch people's story just come alive in their face. It shifts them mentally. And it then creates what you call a deep listening. You know, the Otto Sharma's principle of listening. So you talk about the deep listening when it really shifts that level. And once it shifts, oh my goodness, it's no turning back. So it helps to improve the health and well-being of a person when they look and start to explore, as long as it's done responsibly. And for me, it's always about creating a safe environment for people to operate from, so that they can start to explore. There are barriers. I like that question. There really, really, really are barriers. The biggest barrier for me are the lack and gaps in knowledge about our roots. And I know people keep going on about it, but for me, it's stuff around, I don't know, what's the country of origins, national anthem, what's the national flower, stuff, sort of informational stuff. What's the family structure? What existed? What time period did, for example, and understanding that not everybody was enslaved that are of African ancestry. You talk about your Igbo relative. That could be traced back to maybe 1800s. Rather than back to the 17th century or even 16th century, because there are a new wave of indentured laborers that arrived after 1838 from Africa and Asia. So it's a real multi-layer, and there's a plurality in our communities, and it's quite complex, but it's wonderful when we explore that and start to look at who we are. Then I always talk about redefining our identity and the opportunity to reorganize that and not so much reorganize, but create our new identity, have a better understanding, because you're right about the processes. For example, the Migration Act of 1948, how that changed so many things for people. And people had migrated to the UK before Windrush, but mass migration pretty much started around about then. So I guess that's a good starting point. But I am concerned about the barriers that we still have. I'm very concerned about the role racism plays in our society that prevents people from exploring confidently who they are and wanting to learn. Also, I'm concerned about the barriers within our own communities, because we're time pressured, we're busy surviving, so we haven't got time to organise and create these groups. We're doing our very best on local levels. I like what you said in an article some time back about there are many people out there doing things on a local level, so we're trying to do our bit. It may be small, big, whatever, but we're doing our best. Mm-hmm. But I'm passionate about getting that message out there, and passionate. I've been in this field for many, many years, well over 15 years, so I'm very, very, very passionate about the work needs to be done. We do need to build and grow together. But I think it's about creating safe environments and building those community voices.
And one of the things I want to add on to that, and you're so right, is that and I'm passionate about being out in the community. I don't really like talking thing. I said early, I just want to take action and go direct to the community. And one thing that On History does is attend a lot of festivals, heritage festivals, where we can speak to people directly, because there's information out, there's lots to be discovered, but people don't know.
They
really don't know, and the younger generation is who I want to hit most importantly, and it's a family thing. So to have some presence and to make it look colourful and exciting, as you said, it's not all about our ancestors were enslaved. You said indentured labourers came over, so we never know where our lines go. But if you don't know it exists, if you don't know the work can be done, this is why the stories, whether it's through myself or other people's stories, have to be put out there in bright lights. But we need to be in the heart of our community and present our works, and that's the reason that the workshops have been quite successful, because people didn't realize what they could do with just a few bits of information about their family, and there was a deep desire to know, because of whether it's the Windrush scandal that's triggered it, whether it's the elders now passing away, and there's a big fear that they're passing away with that knowledge. But what do? They've gone online and got stuck and just think, well, ancestry hasn't given me much, so there's no reason to go any further. So I've had to go out there. I've done a lot of work in this last year to really exhibit at different events and showcase my work.
I know we spoke about this before, Adrian. I know you probably don't, but do you think the government should put their hand in their pockets, because we are taxpayers, and they should be funding more stuff around? I think it's part of the whole restorative justice aspects of the Windrush scandal, I personally believe. I'm not talking about the wider just in the context of the Windrush scandal, because if you look at the heart of the Windrush scandal, people were told you didn't have the paperwork, but even though they didn't have the paperwork in the first place. And one of the key things, that I'm speaking to a lot of victim survivors, they talk about a loss of identity. They mention it all the time. We've had two shows, haven't we, on looking at issues around mental health and Windrush, and people keep on talking about the impact on their identity. Surely the government, as part of the wider compensation or recognition, there should be funding stuff like what you're doing.
Absolutely. I may not be out there in the last year doing, but where I've been working with other organisations and community is bringing that address, the issue around about that missing identity. And I didn't realise how apparent that was until the Windrush scandal, how in an instant, a person's identity just wiped. The impact has just been way too great. It's bad enough as a community that we're dealing with prevailing issues that are prevailing within our society that we've had to manage, and it still isn't managed, because we overrepresent in the BME community, particularly African Caribbean and African community, maybe more particularly the African Caribbean communities, in the mental health sector. Why is that the case? That needs to be explored. And then on top of that, with the Windrush scandal, the government needs to stop the fact-checking mentality and approach, and more hand-holding for some of the communities. Support the organisations, in particular those that are third sector, trying to do something about redressing this. Fund them to do some meaningful opportunities to redress this situation, quite urgently, in fact. So, yes, I believe the government should put their hands in their pocket and do something about it and fund it.
What about you, Adrian?
I think you know where I stand with this. I think for me, I get it. And you're seeing it happen with Glasgow University and the reparation that's been paid.
Yeah.
I guess there's part of me that doesn't care. I don't care. I've always looked at it like I'm investing it in myself. I'm putting my hand in my pocket. I'm running on history. I'm self-funded. That's how it should be. And basically delivering what we need. I'm not thinking about the politics. I'm thinking about well, the direct audience is where I live. We're in the community. I live in the community. This is my contribution. So I just got the ball rolling and having had many conversations with different, you know, organizations about working together, and it's already happening. So for me, that's part of the solution, by thinking, what are you actually going to do? Mm-hmm. Instead of thinking, well, okay, I've got funded to do one project, then I've got to think about another project that's going to happen another 2 years later, or because it's successful, they're going to withdraw the funding. I don't have to think about those things because, you know, I've built the direct contacts or built the confidence and the resources to deliver it myself. And that's how I was able to keep the momentum and, you know, to kind of continue to deliver these events. Every single one that I've done has sold out. Every single one has been packed. So why do I need to ask permission to invest in myself? It doesn't make no sense for me. It's going back to the plantation to invest in myself. That's the mentality. So I have to go to funding to learn about my history. That doesn't make any sense. I'm going to the same government that
to learn about yourself,
to learn about myself, that passes that through Parliament to make slavery illegal. It didn't make no sense. I wasn't really consciously thinking about it from the very beginning. I was just like, well, this is the journey that I want to go on to, so I'm going to fund it. And then the family are going to support me if they need to be, which kind of happened. So it became our thing. And then it just rolled out that way when I started thinking how to grow own history. I just asked for how much it cost to hire the venue. And it just went like that. And I did, because I came from a music background, music production. So I was already thinking about imagery and how to make an impact, because I had to think to myself how to connect this message to the community. So I went to all the barbershops, the Caribbean shops, put the posters up, went on the streets, in the markets, handed the flyers out. I said, this is what I'm doing. This is, you know, explained what could be done by, you know, as I said, by a few simple steps. And people were like, oh my gosh, this is something that I always wanted to do. It was just as simple as that.
Just put it out there.
Door knocking, the chit chatting, name it.
Stop
it all
speaking
counts.
To me with veins popping at your neck. You know, there's so many different problems. But as I said, this was a celebrative thing. This was something that I wanted to do. Well, the journey was full of joy, as well as, you know, discovering many, you know, deep, dark things. But at the same time, it was bringing people together. One birth certificate in the 1900s could have the whole family around. Oh my gosh, look at the handwriting, look at the name. It's the same name that was passed down. Look at the occupations, you know, so all these things are empowerment. So it's about grabbing that power by the hands, taking control and doing things.
And empowering people to really look at themselves more meaningfully, I guess.
Yeah.
And avoid what is called a single story scenario. I like this talk by Chimamanda, my apologies, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's TED Talk 2009 about the single story, being mindful of that. Because of what we face as a community, constantly seen as one perspective, and it's repeated and repeated until it becomes a stereotype. And we have a hell of a job unchipping all of that. And it's working towards minimizing that for sure. That's my end goal. Yes, I sort of stuck in the combination of dark and light, but for me, I was raised in Jamaica and I had really good positive experience. My first day when I flew on a plane with my mum and my sister, shared the same airplane as the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh, because they were flying to the island. And
you
typical
first class then?
Oh no, I wish we were. We had to wait forever. And a double thing for me, that was my first trip there. And in addition to that, my brother, who was a member of the Jamaica Defence Force, it was a military personnel. He had two roles: wait once for the Queen disembark from the airplane, and then to wait for us to meet us for the first time. It was really weird. So for me, my shifting about who I am started right there and then when I was a kid. And I saw when I returned to the UK how one-storied our community was, and it really bugged me because my experience in Jamaica, yes, we do have issues in the Caribbean around about the colorism and so on and so forth. That's still a work in progress. But we did also have a multiple diverse experience, and I didn't see that emanated here in the UK. So I thought I came from a different perspective about looking at this.
Okay. It's been fascinating speaking to you both about tracing our family history and tracing our roots. I have really enjoyed speaking to you. But before you go, where can our listeners get in touch with you online if they need help tracing their family lineage?
Okay, if you're lucky enough to get a space for the Tracing Your Windrush Roots workshop, I'm going to tell you again. You need to act now. You can book it on tracingwindrushroots.eventbrite.co.uk through Eventbrite. That's own history. So that's tracingyourwindrushroots.eventbrite.co.uk, or you can find me on own.history through Instagram. as well as Facebook, Adrian Stone. So there's a few different ways.
Okay, and for me, and for it's Sharon Tomlin underscore RSD. That's the Instagram. I'm working on a website and writing, but also I'll be presenting as well at various boroughs in the coming weeks. So and watch your space, Eventbrite as well. But also if people really want to directly contact me, it's sharon@rootschange.com. So that would be one way. And Roots is spelled R-O-U-T-E-S change.com.
Yeah. Fantastic. You have been listening to the Voices of Windrush with Sinai Flary and my co-host Mr. Patrick Vernon, and in the studio today we were speaking to Sharon Tomlin, who is a family historian and genealogist, and Adrian Stone, who is a genealogist. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Colorful
Sinai, colorful, and Patrick colorful, on colorful, colorful Radio.